is based on chapter 2, and I also took some things from various sources, one of which was Alexander Del Mar's A History of Money in Ancient Countries from the Earliest Times to the Present, 1885, in New York, published. And Stephen likes him a lot. I have a number of his books. He's, you know, the Lost Science of Money is based on his book, The Science of Money. So, so we'll go. Here we go. With special focus on the bronze fiat money of the Roman Republic. You guys want to have a question?
I'm okay.
So I just want to review the themes, because to me, this is what I walk around with week to week, thinking the primary importance of the money of power, the nature of money purposely kept secret and confused, and we can figure out by who. How a society defines money determines who controls the society. And the battle over control of money has raged for millennia, and we see it in this chapter. Okay, so that's the themes.
And yeah, that's basically his thesis.
Yeah.
Yeah, his hypothesis that he proves.
Yeah.
Wants to prove.
So the first thing I did is I made a timeline of just what we're going to be talking about in terms of how the money changed, right? So you can see the kingdom, then the republic, and then the empire. So, and under the kingdom, there are two specific kings that Stephen identifies as having some monetary importance, Numa and Tullius, one in the 8th century and then the other in the 6th century. And then in the Republic, we're going to focus on 385 to 263, which is over 100 years, which is when the unification of the Italian peninsula took place. Okay. And after that, in the 3rd century BC, you have these wars. I mean, it seemed to me, I mean, if there's someone here who's really studied Roman history, but it seems to me the Greeks and Romans were always fighting. I mean, there wasn't much, it was part of the nature of maintaining one's sovereignty, it seems, in these civilizations. And but the Punic Wars were major, Stephen uses them as major watersheds with the history of money in Rome. And you have, in that later part of the Republic, the growth of wealth and power in a plutocracy, the annexation of the provinces, when Rome was expanding its sovereignty over the peninsula of Italy, it didn't extract tribute from the other tribes. It just said, you have to join the Commonwealth, and we're ahead of it. I heard something, some screeching, so, but it's gone. But now, at the later part of the Republic, you have the annexation of provinces outside of Italy, where they do extract tribute from the provinces. And then the growth of the latifundia, which is the large slave plantations in Italy. And then the empire from 27 BC to, well, you can date it to 476 when the Western Roman Empire fell, or you can continue on with the Eastern Byzantine Empire in Constantinople that went on to 1204 when Constantinople was attacked by the Christian knights and raped of all of their gold. And then it went, the actual Eastern Roman Empire did manage to keep going until 1453, when Constantinople totally fell to the Ottoman Empire. So that's sort of the high point of the history. Any questions on that? Okay. So the Roman kingdom. Rome had seven kings, and we're going to look at King Numa Pompilius and King Servius Tullius, 8th and 6th century. And that's Rome there. That's the Roman kingdom. It's a little piece. You can see the inset, right? So, for some reason, this Roman kingdom grew to be an empire. King Numa. So before King Numa, metal lumps of bronze called Ais Rude were traded by weight. And Ais, I don't know how to pronounce that. I had Latin for 4 years in high school, but we never spoke it.
I would say Ais Rude.
Ais Rude. Did you have Latin?
Et cum spiritu tuo.
You have the Catholic Church, right, okay. Ais Rude. And you say it with your hand going up and
well,
down.
Well, the priest does, you.
Making the cross, right. Okay, Ais Rude. So that was what they used, they traded with them, and by weight. Now, Kinua's monetary decision was to monetize the bronze, not gold or silver. And, well, why don't you read the first thing? Because this is, or Martin, because I think Martin brought this point up.
Let Martin read it.
Okay. Plutarch's Lives. Numa was descended of the Sabians, who declared themselves to be a colony of the, wow, Spartans.
Lacedaemonians, I would say. Lacedaemonians?
Thank you. Lycurgus of Sparta lived prior to Numa. Plutarch chose to make Numa and Lycurgus parallel lives.
Yeah, I think that's significant, that he chose to do that. You know, he did parallel lives. He put two people together in his books, you know. And you can go online and read these, the lives of Numa. It's very interesting. Yeah. You get the details, the quality of the life and everything. And you read the details about these two guys. But he chose to put them together. So I think that's significant. And then Numa began casting rough bronze bars. So instead of just this Ais Rude, he had these bars, you can see them, the picture of them, and he created a monetary unit called the Numi, 2.5 pounds of bronze, or it was also called, the Ais means bronze, or 2.5 Ais. So that was the weight of the bronze that was considered a monetary unit. And it indicated some state control over the money, okay? So they were pretty big bars. The consequences of making bronze the only legal tender, it disenfranchised gold and silver of the Eastern temples and merchants, and the gold limited to the use in jewelry or for paying for foreign trade. But in Rome itself, the only legal tender was the Numi, the bronze by weight bars. But that was very significant, you know, because there were other peoples at that time in Italy, other tribes that used gold and silver, you know. So King Numa had something on the ball here. King, now, two centuries later, King Servius, he took the bronze bars and he cast them in a more pure form called aes signatum, stamped bronze. And you can see some examples there. The pictures are more detailed, they're more artistic, they're still pretty big. And these became the legal tender in Rome. And the other thing is that they started to circulate in the peninsula, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is that actual size, what we're seeing there? Well, I guess we have no way of knowing.
Stephen, I think at one point in the chapter, Stephen does give the measurements of them. And they're pretty big.
Yeah.
They're pretty big. Yeah. Aes signatum. The other thing about Tullius is he monetized the bronze by his first census here. So he had a census, the very first census ever in Rome, and he required everyone to contribute a certain coin per head. So men were paying one kind of coin, women another, children another. And they took them to separate temples. And so it's not clear whether these payments were the bars, or if there were metallic coin, bronze coins, but the weights were still there. The 1 pound of copper was one aes, aes meaning bronze metal, and the one numus was 2.5 aes, or 2.5 pounds of copper. And these coins, and maybe someone else figured it out from the chapter, but as far as I know, Stephen was saying that these aes grave coins were one of the earliest coins and could have been issued at the time of King Servius. I mean, like we saw in the chapter, all of these numismuses, most of them, except for someone like the historian Mommsen or something, you know, they pretty much looked at all of these coins as commodity coins, you know. So Stephen, with the help of Del Mar and the help of Mommsen, the historian, and a few others, is carving out this piece of history about the fiat money, you know. The Roman Republic. So I just put a few slides to get the quality of what the Republic was, because I don't know, I've never studied it, and I had no idea what a Roman Republic was. I know a little bit about the American Republic. So Anne, why don't you read that?
Roman Republic, 509 BC to 27 BC, and we have some illustrations of the consuls, the Senate, and the Tribune. Government headed by two consuls, elected annually by citizens and advised by a Senate. 494 BC, a struggle took place during which the lower class plebes seceded from the city. The secession led to a negotiated settlement with the upper class patricians, and as a result, the plebeians were given increased rights, including the right to elect their own magistrates named tribunes. A constitution centered on the principles of separation of powers and checks and balances. Not bad.
Not bad. I thought that was interesting that the plebs just seceded from the city. Yeah. They left. They said, they're leaving. I mean, it's like pretty cool, you know. But I mean, there's so many details about the Roman history, their laws, their government. I mean, this is just the high point, you know. But it is, you know, an incredible history. And so, and this is as of 264, right before the Punic Wars. This is the government, and you can see the patricians.
Excuse me, was that Carthage?
Carthage.
Okay.
Yeah. You can see the patricians and the plebeians, and you can see they had these citizen assemblies, and then they would elect, the plebes would elect the tribunes, and it looks at this point that part of the plebes and part of the patricians would elect the senators, of which there were 300. There were only 10 tribunes. And then you still have the two consuls. And I'm sure the politics were, I mean, that's what I got from the chapter too. Incredible politics, especially when you get to the emperors. It's bad enough at the consuls, you know. Okay, so 400 BC, this is Italy, prior to the unification by Rome of the peninsula. Okay, so you can see the Roman Empire is that little sliver of land in the Adriatic Sea. But you see the other tribes, the Etrurians, the Umbrians, the Samnites, the Messapes, and Apulians. Down at the bottom in Sicily, you have the Greeks in Sicily, I think they're the yellow.
No, I'm sorry.
And you have the little part of Sicily is the Carthaginians, whose main... Yep. Civilization is in Tunisia, in northern Africa. So this is 400 BC, and in 406 BC, marked bronze pieces were the only legal tender at this point. Okay. And there we go, 264 BC, after unification, and there's the Roman Republic, and they assimilated through wars, but they've assimilated into a commonwealth all of those tribes. Okay, and you still have, and there's Carthage. Carthage is the purple. And you can see at this point, Carthage has a good part of the island of Sicily at the toe of Italy. It's got Sardinia and Corsica in the Adriatic Sea. It has southern part of Spain, and it has all along the northwest African coast. You can see Carthage is this. You can vaguely see it. It's faces. It actually faces the toe of Italy on northern Africa.
I can't read it. What's that little bit there?
No, what's the little Greek bit?
The Greek Syracuse.
Syracuse, okay.
Yeah. They weren't in the Commonwealth yet.
Syracuse. Did they belong to Greece at that time?
I don't know. Does anybody know?
Well,
I don't know.
No.
They might have been a Greek colony, but they might have been their own city-state.
Yeah.
You know. So you have from 400...
Yes, said Greeks.
It says Greeks. Oh, okay, yeah. Good. Okay, so the Republic's money system, right? So let me just fast forward here some, because I just want you to see something here. Where is it? oh, here. Just so you know, the details of this extraordinary money system are lost. The decrees of the Roman Senate, which would have recorded all of the decrees about the money, because the money was issued by the Senate, all those records have perished. Mm. You know, wouldn't it be great if we had that? But unfortunately, they're not here. So we're needing to look at those historians that recorded a couple of hundred years after and had their own view of history, back the ancient Greek and Roman historian, and look at the coins and try to figure it out that way. So this is Stephen and Alexander Del Mar. So when did that fiat system start? In 385 BC, the Gauls invaded and sacked Rome.
Is that true?
Yeah.
385 BC?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the Celts. The Gallic Celts. They were right on the top of the peninsula, and they came in and they sacked Rome. You know. The invasion caused Romans to change many particulars of policy. It was like a very devastating. Any time, you know, you're in a war, but particularly getting into the heart of Rome and taking over the city. So among these would very likely have been a system of money. And Delmar says this is the point at which the Servian system of money terminated, King Servius. Okay. So 338 to 266, the Italian peninsula is unified. The Romans struck copper coins, the numus, 2.5 bronze, pounds of bronze, by law. And the numis value became several multiples of its bronze content value. So you have coins that have value by law greater than the weight of the metal they're made out of. Okay. And as Rome took over the other tribes, the gold and silver money of those tribes disappeared, and the Roman copper money with Roman weights and measures took their place. So this is what Stephen wants to prove.
Okay. Can you say that again? What Stephen wants to prove is what? Can you say it that way?
That after the invasion of the Celts, the Gauls, in 385 BC, which sacked Rome, right? They changed their money system. They changed it to this fiat system, and they struck copper coins, which was better than casting them, striking them with this, you know, they do it with the hammer, and it makes it.
What does Stephen want to prove? I mean,
that there was a fiat money system. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. During this unification, there were bullion silver coins minted. Okay. They were minted by Rome, but not circulated in the city and not part of a regular monetary system. They didn't have any value markings on them, and they circulated in the southern regions of the peninsula, and they were used with foreigners. Okay? So again, this is his explanation of these coins and all these new instances they're trying to figure out.
So the implication that the coin was more worth more than the actual metal that it was made of.
Yes.
Does what? Makes it not a commodity, right?
Not a commodity money. Right.
Okay.
Makes it a fiat. So it's valued by what the law says. And these are some of the bullion coins that they found, the Romano and the Roma. It says Roma right on it. And you can see, it's very
delicate.
Very delicate.
History,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's changed since the Aes Rudae. That's another thing. If someone wants to do some research on the whole metals mining and how that affects the whole economy, you know, I think that's something that I never got in my education, you know, the significance of all of that.
Well, wouldn't these also be valued on the weight of the silver that was in them, especially for dealing with the foreign people?
Well, say that again. You came across a little fuzzy.
Okay. To deal with foreign people, you had to have something like that it was dealt with on the weight of the silver in the coin. There must have been some value based on the actual silver.
Well, yeah, the market value.
Yeah. Yeah, these have a market value because they got silver in them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what's meant
and
by...
So,
that's what I mean by bullion silver.
Okay.
So bullion and silver is the value of the metal in the market, the commodity value, versus the value by law that this coin is said to have.
Okay. So these were dual. They were fiat money and money by market value.
Well, the fiat money was from the bronze metal only.
Yeah, but Mark just said, but this wasn't circulated in Rome.
Right. Right.
Okay. So yeah. I don't know.
It's a trade. Outside the ropes.
Yeah. What's Martin saying?
It's for trade.
Yeah.
The coins were for trade. So they probably had two values. They had what they were stamped, and then if you wanted to buy something from somebody from the Orient, you had to pay in the commodity value of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a bullion silver. So, the details, I read this before, the details of this system are lost because all the decrees of the Roman Senate, which were all recorded and kept in the treasury of Paris, I think at the fall of Rome. Maybe someone will find them someday. There's something there to be dug up. It'll be great. So, where did this fiat system come from? Did someone else read it? Jeff, you want to read it?
No.
Okay, Jeff's going to read it.
454 BC, Roman ambassadors sent to Athens to study the laws of Solon and Greek political institutions. They must have been appraised of the Greek system of money, which provided numeraries for home use and precious metals for foreign service. One of Solon's contributions to Athenian law was a provision that made animals legal tender. 454 BC, the Roman lex something.
Aeternia tarpeia.
Monetized cattle and sheep, which could be tended directly for fines. One sheep equaled 10 acres.
Aces.
And yeah. One oxen equals 100 aces.
Right.
Very good Latin pronunciation.
Yeah, that's the law. One of the Roman laws that was passed, lex Aeternia tarpeia. So this is again, what Stephen and Delmore is postulating, some of the connections of the concepts of fiat money from the Greeks and their money systems that, well, you have these Roman ambassadors going over to study it. I like those pictures of the animals. So, overview, this is an overview of the bronze nomisma, the bronze fiat money. So the Republic's money system was abstract and legal. The tail of the money, what the value stamped on it, overvalued the copper content. So there was a monopolization of the fabrication of money by the government, right? And it consisted of these copper numi, formerly known as aces, and now known as numi, fiat money. This limitation of emissions by the Senate, there's only one kind of money for all purposes. The legal tender was the bronze numi. It had a specific material of copper, unique to it, and it was It was secure against counterfeiting by being struck instead of cast. Being struck made it less able to be counterfeited. And it used mechanical devices that created very high art, high define, that also made it hard to counterfeit. And there were very severe penalties in the law if you counterfeited. So this is the overview, and this 385 to 207. Now, what I did was, Alexander Del Mar, in the book that I told you the title of, History of Money in Ancient Countries, he has 19 reasons why the system existed, either that support that the system existed, or show how people who say it didn't exist, how they're wrong. One or the other. One's more positive, one's sort of negative. But he has 19 reasons, so I included all of them because it's, you know, since all the records are gone, this is what we have to argue with, you know. So the following are the 19 reasons Alexander Del Mar gave.
So this is not in Stephen's book.
No, but parts of the concepts are in his book. This is taken from this book here. So the first one, and excuse all the... Fran, why don't you read this?
So I'll read this one.
Yeah.
Okay, so monopoly, restricted emission, and overvaluation of bronze pieces. So, fabrication of pieces monopolized by state, all stamped SC, meaning ex senatus consulto, which means by decree of the Senate, to the end of the empire, the Senate was in charge of this coinage. Pieces were uniform designed and executed with much art and mechanical skill. These facts point to monopoly and limitation of the coinage. And we are informed different pieces were fabricated in each district or colony and were distinguished by others by peculiar mint marks and kept in each place. Such control and restriction would not have been necessary with a commodity system.
Yeah, they would have just gone all over because the weight would have been the same and they would have been, you know, have the same value all over. And you can see the SC on the coin.
I just didn't follow what you just said about a commodity system.
I guess that just is... commodity system's a bit confusing there. I guess you just mean it wouldn't be so regular if it wasn't controlled by the state. Don't you mean?
Well, with the commodity system, you get the commodity coin in your hand, and you it has a certain weight of the metal, and that metal has a certain market value. So if you have a coin that has this market value because there's a weight of 2 grams, say, of silver, right? You can take that throughout the Roman Empire, you know, the Roman Commonwealth, and you'll get the market value for that coin. Because it's deduced from the weight of the metal in it. So why would you mint a commodity coin and keep it in one area when the weight doesn't change if it goes from one area to the other? It's the same value. I think that's what this means. Does anyone else?
The market value of this coin is determined by the markings on it, not necessarily by the weight, but it was uniform.
So you're saying that in the commodity money, someone can take this somewhere else and get more money for it?
Well, if the market value is different. Well, that's what they did. They took it to India and got...
So is that what you're saying?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, they didn't use bronze because bronze was a very precious metal.
No, I understand. Yeah. I understand. But I think the concept of commodity is that you can use it other than money in that place where it was created. You can go somewhere else and they can melt it down and get more money for it somewhere else. It's a commodity. It can be traded. It's not used as money.
But look at the title of this slide, Over Evaluation of Bronze Pieces.
Right.
The bronze wasn't worth what it said that what the stamp said the piece was worth.
Right. No, I understand that. So his argument here is that because they haven't found this all over, wherever all over means, it was a fiat money system. Is that right? I mean,
they were found all over. They were fabricated in each district.
But they were different in each district.
But they weren't found in the Far East or whatever he's... I don't know what...
Oh, yeah. This was in Italy.
Just Italy.
In Rome or whatever.
I mean, he's saying it's very localized because you couldn't use it as a commodity. It didn't get...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's worth X because they say it's worth X, that's all.
Yeah.
Well, you'd be a fool to take this overvalued bronze piece and melt it down and go out and get the bronze value for it because it's worth more in the coin.
That's right.
Yeah. But I think he's saying here, that the pieces were executed with much art and mechanical skill. And you wouldn't have to do that. I think he's implying you wouldn't have to do that if it was a monopoly money, because really what makes the difference with the monopoly money is the weight of the commodity metal it's made out of. So, why create something exquisite,
meticulous? Well, he says these facts point to monopoly and limitation of the coinage.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is a fiat, the fiat. Quality of fiat.
Yeah.
Fiat money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. This is fiat.
Oh, what?
No. It's fiat money, so we're now at two.
Okay. Anne, why don't you do two?
Okay. Absence of complaints about repeated reductions. The copper, as was reduced many times. The copper ace was reduced many times. Yet
in weight. Weight of copper.
My smartphone is getting dumb. I'm sorry. All right.
Okay. So, reduced many times in the weight of the copper in it.
Okay. Yet nowhere in Roman history do there appear any complaints. Not a problem with a numerical fiat system. For an intrinsic commodity system, this would have caused great consequences.
Yeah. Does that make sense, Jeff?
Yeah.
That's convincing.
I think that's a strong point, actually. Maybe all the complaints have been erased from history, but I would think they'd find their way at least into some of the historians back then in the ancient world, Will, why don't you do this one?
Okay. Unrestricted private coinage of silver and gold by, what's that word? What's that mean?
That's the families.
Gentes.
Patrician families. Gentes.
Oh, okay. Not legal tender, coined 269 BC and 207 BC. Used to reward soldiers of gentes and armies of the Republic, and then not permitted to form part of the monetary system of Republic, copper as accepted as fiat money besides unrestrained emission of gentes. I don't understand what that said.
The gentes were the patrician families of Rome.
And okay.
Now this period he's talking about is during the Punic Wars. So the soldiers would want to be paid in silver or gold because they would be billeted in areas where they were using silver and gold coins. You know. So there were these emissions, but he makes a point that they weren't legal tender. They didn't have stamped on them SC, you know, with a value. I put in the question mark because Stephen indicates there's a question, there's this question by numismatists, well, who issued these coins? Was it the private families or was it the Roman government? So that's a question. And Del Mar in 1885 said it was the patrician families. Okay. So, Nelson.
Martin.
I have a hard time remembering Martin. How
do you
remember this?
Monopoly. Monopoly of copper mines by the state. 4. No mining was permitted to private individuals. Mines were under the sole control of the state.
So what about that?
So the government had sole control of the currency that way. If they're using copper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It seems like a pretty strong argument. And Del Mar had a lot of different hats that he wore. At one point he was working for the U.S. government in the Office of Statistics. But he also was a metallurgist. And he went to all these mines, the Roman and the Greek mines, and he saw them, you know. He's very interesting. He makes a point. He said a lot of them were closed in the ancient world, and they have never been opened since.
So he's basically saying that this was fiat money because it was controlled by the state.
Yes, they control the source of it. One of the arguments.
Yeah, he's there 19, right?
Yeah.
This could be a song. 19 Reasons Why.
Okay, restrictions upon commerce in copper. It appeared, and this is, I know, he's pulling everything out of the hat, but this is all they have to work with. It appears from a passage in Cicero that the Romans were not unfamiliar with the policy of restricting the commerce in the substances of which the symbols of money were composed. It is therefore not improbable, though we are without any positive evidence on this point, that they restricted the commerce of copper during the Consular Republic and the prevalence of the numerical system of money. So that's another one of his arguments. And he read all of these, Roman authors and picked out these things. Anne, why don't you do this one?
Variety of qualities of copper employed in fabricating the pieces. Assays of the coins,
yes,
still extant, show that the material of which the various copper coins of this period were made was different. These inferences and facts are fatal to the theory of a commodity or intrinsic system of money.
That's pretty strong.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a commodity system, the coins all have to weigh the same, mm-hmm, and have the and have the same market value. I mean, the quality. You get some shitty copper. You're not going to get anything for it. Yeah. Seven. Lack of uniformity in the weights of the pieces. Weights of the pieces. Right? That this one was quality of the copper used in the pieces. This is the weight. It is essential to all intrinsic or commodity systems of money that every piece of like nominal value shall be of the same weight and fineness of metal or other material. So again, it's a requirement of the commodity, and it's not met by these fiat coins. Okay. They won't, you know, they weren't all the exact same weight, you know.
Yeah, all different sizes.
Right. Let's get this. Okay, eight.
Copper was abundance and cheapness of copper metal. Copper was abundantly produced in various parts of Italy, in Campania and Tuscany and Sicily, and many of the mines worked at that period, at first by the Etruscans and afterwards by the Romans, remain productive at the present day, 1885. Copper thus would be unfit for commodity money since Rome did not exercise substantial control over it.
This is at the time of the tribes, okay? He's talking early on, before Rome consolidated the peninsula and gained control of those mines. Is that something you can share, Will?
I got some more in the fridge. Come on over.
Email it to us.
And there you can see a mine, an actual mine, ancient mine, right there, those holes.
Productive at the present day, 1885.
That's Monte Moretto in the Ligurian region. That's that red region of Italy, where some of the earliest known copper mines in Europe, even before the Roman kingdom. So they have had copper quite a way time there. Okay. Fran, why don't you do this one?
Okay, so plentiful of copper implements and utensils, 9. Had the monetary system been intrinsic, an enormous mass of copper or bronze would have stood ready at all times for conversion into money, and this fact endangers the steadiness of prices. Delmar said, the usual material for the fabrication of weapons, tools, implements, utensils, and works of art was copper or bronze.
Right. The iron, at the time of the early Republic, iron was not, he said, was really not used in the Roman Commonwealth. It was still bronze from the Bronze Age. And you can see there's one of a sculpture made from bronze of a Roman girl. In fact, I think Stephen has in his chapter, is it in Stephen's chapter where he says they needed more bronze and they went and they melted down all the bronze statues during the empire. Yeah, that's what they did. Okay. Will, why don't you do this one?
The inferiority of copper, the commodity, copper, it corrodes, it's plentiful, and it's difficult to protect from counterfeiting.
Yeah, I guess if you have something that's corroding and it's a commodity money, then you're losing value with it.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a picture of a corroding copper pipe. Easily corrodes too. Mark, why don't you do this one?
Okay. Amplitude of gold and silver supplies. If Romans wanted a commodity system, it would be gold and silver. Rome possessed considerable quantities of precious metals in public treasury, commercial payments to foreign merchants, religious purposes, for use of soldiers. These coins were not money, but merchandise. Rome was not destitute of gold and silver mines. And three, Rome traded with Greece, Carthage, and the Gauls, all of whom had silver or gold.
So in other words, if she wanted to have gold and silver as their money, she definitely could have, right?
Yeah.
As a commodity system. Jeff, you want to do this one?
Why don't you do it?
I'll do it.
It's your turn.
Is it preposterous relation of copper to silver? The mark. Now, this. I tried to put this down. Someone else understands this better than me because I get confused with the math. But the market ratio of copper to silver in Rome was 140 to 1. Okay?
Right.
Not 720 to 1 as deduced from the text of Pliny. If you go to Pliny and you see what he's saying, it would be this outrageous number. If you apply Pliny's analysis as a commodity money, right? If the copper coins were intrinsic or commodity, it must be believed that the Sicilian mint at the foot of the peninsula would exchange a pound of silver for 140 pounds of copper. You could buy 140 pounds of copper. But the Roman mint, only 300 miles away, was willing to pay 720 pounds of copper for it. According to Del Mar, it doesn't make any sense.
Okay,
Jeff?
Difficulty in accounting for the subsequent operations of Caligula, reign AD 37 to 41?
Right, here's his picture.
Numa was overvalued in Caligula's time.
That's the bronze coins.
He was the first to break through emission restrictions of Senate and monopolized the Numa himself and proceed to coin them as rapidly as possible. If Numi was overvalued in Caligula's time, this supports that Numi overvalued in prior times, during Commonwealth, when power of the Senate to keep emissions within specific limit was greater.
So if they were still overvalued in his time, then when the Senate was stronger, they would have been more overvalued.
Incredibility of prices and sums mentioned in ancient authors. Translating sums and prices in Roman history as a commodity money makes them too large, not reconcilable with truth. Example, Augustus is said to have received by the testaments of his friends 32,291,666 British pounds.
Right. So they did this work on this, did this work with the math. Fran, why don't you do that one?
Okay. 15, the example of other states, so Sparta. Monetary systems of numerical character had been tried in several of the states with which Rome was connected through commerce, notably Greece and Carthage. The Romans adopted the Greek name for money. They called it numus, after the Greek nomisma. They would have understood the significance of this term.
We talked about that earlier with the relationship of numa to the Spartans. Well,
okay. The advice of publicists. 16. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Zeno, and other great teachers of philosophy and politics had all written of numerical systems of money, and the most revered of them all had recommended such a system for his ideal republic.
Okay.
I guess it would have been Plato.
That's the second from the left. So to me this is very strong proof. I mean, these concepts were very well understood by these philosophers. To even create it in the Republic of Plato, you know. Martin. I couldn't get
extreme that. Danger of a commodity system. Sorry?
I was just going to say, I
have a hard time understanding this.
I couldn't get a picture from the ancient world. I put that in.
Okay. Extreme danger of a commodity system at this period. An enemy could quietly withdraw the precious metal in circulation or quietly add illegal fabricated coins to circulation to alter the... entire relations of society.
So that's the danger of a commodity system.
So isn't that what happens today? And very quietly, people don't know that the banks are creating, they'll hear about bubbles, or they hear about the stock markets going up, but they don't, they don't really connect it to, all this money is being created. Or, hey, the money's disappearing, right? I mean, so happens throughout all of American history, all the booms and busts.
So does that mean we have commodities?
Well, here, you're talking about other people could control your economy by withdrawing the precious metal. Other people, outside people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. What he's talking. Yeah.
I think he's saying this has gone on throughout the book. This is a theme, I think.
Yes. Yeah. The control of your money.
If it's not a commodity.
Well, I think just the control of your money, who controls it?
Yeah.
Right.
Because right.
But here's trying to prove the commodity aspect of it.
Right. Yeah. If it was gold and silver, precious metals, commodity money. Yeah.
So it's what? Is it something about what? It's important what money is.
Yes.
Okay. Allusions to a numerical system in the Corpus Juris Civilis, Julius Paulus III, 18, Julius Paulus III century AD. A device was chosen whose legal and permanent value remedied the difficulties of barter. This device being officially promulgated circulated and maintained its purchasing power, not so much from its substance as from its quantity.
So there's another very well-known ancient, he's a jurist, recognizing fiat money and recognizing some of the rules with it, officially promulgated.
You guys make a play.
Control the quantity. And
the terminology of money. The generic name for money during the Servian period was aes, referring to the principal material of which money was composed. During the Commonwealth, its name was numis, which as plainly refers to its numerical character.
The volume of it. Controlling the number of coins in circulation. He calls that the numerary system or fiat system. And that's Del Mar. Alexander Del Mar. He wrote many books on this topic about monies all over the world and all different times. Quite a writer. Okay, so going forward, the Punic Wars. Okay. So, at the outbreak, this is Rome, at the outbreak of the First Punic War in 264. So you see, it's the peninsula, the Commonwealth. During the First Punic War and the Second Punic War, there was a circulation of silver bullion coins, not legal tender, right? They were bullion, commodity coins. In the very early part of the war, one of those bullion coins is 10 aces or 10 pounds of bronze. And later on, in the Second Punic War, that the silver coin became 16 pounds of copper. So it changed the market value of it. This was one of the things that did happen because of the wars, the use of the silver bullion coin. In 218 BC, this is during the Second Punic War, the outbreak of it, and there you can see, at that point, Rome has taken from Carthage, has taken Sicily, the Carthaginian province in Sicily, and also Sardinia and Corsica, okay? But they were warring many, many years, you know? So the silver denarius is coined at this point in the Second Punic War as legal tender. This is a big step, big step. Its marked value on it is 10 asses, 10 pounds of copper. That's the value of it marked on it. It's 4 silver sesterces is equal to 1 denarius, so a silver sesterce is 1/4 of a denarius. Therefore, it's 2.5 pounds of copper marked on it. So in doing this, in creating a silver legal tender coin, putting the values on it, equating it to the current legal tender bronze coins, you're linking the two together.
So here's the commodity.
Yeah, this is it. This is the first legal tender of silver. Okay?
Okay.
They marked them with these values because they were trying to treat them the same as they did their fiat bronze coins by putting a value on them. Okay? But they're in the middle of a war. And I'm just going to say, and this man, Hannibal, is raging all over Italy with his elephants. Huge decimation of the Commonwealth. Okay. So, the silver denarius is valued by law, but the issue is not limited. Okay.
No, they closed it down when I walked through it.
When it was introduced, the silver denarius coin contained, and I don't know if we should go into all this math, but it was 1/72 of a pound of silver in it. That's how much silver was actually in one of those silver denarius coins that had stamped on it 10 pounds of bronze, right? A true ounce. Bronze coin, okay, so if you had the bronze coin and it had 2 ounces of bronze in it, was valued at 12 ounces of bronze, okay? So that was the legal values given to these. However, over time, the issues of the silver coins were unlimited. Over time, they were reduced to their commodity value and Rome lost control of its money system. And after 150 BC, little bronze coinage was issued.
Does Will want to say something?
Yeah. Will, were you going to say something?
No.
Okay.
I was just, that's where it happened.
Yeah, and, it, you know, the wars. the wars, and they were, from what I've been reading, they were pretty desperate, because with Hannibal, with the elephants, and, you know. Also, at the outbreak of the Second Punic War was the first gold coinage, okay? 218 BC, Rome borrowed gold jewelry from its citizens and used 4,000 pounds of treasury gold to make the first gold coinages. These were not legal tender, but they were coined. And in 2004, at the end, as you might remember reading, at the end of the Punic Wars, this cult came right into Rome, this black stone from the east, right? Save the day, right. Here we are at the end of the Punic Wars, and you can see that Rome has conquered Carthage in Tunisia, that little red spot. It's gotten the southern, south, and east coasts of Spain. So it's has already these two conquests, and he's also taken Syracuse in Sicily at the foot of the peninsula. So it's already started its conquest, where it will extract tribute from those areas. Okay.
And they totally destroyed Carthage. Okay. So totally that you can't find any remains of the city.
Wow.
Yeah.
They did a lot of that. And
you will be punished.
Oh, yeah. This was a hard... lot of wars. So, the Punic Wars, during the wars was a growing concentration of wealth and power in a plutocracy. The profits from the first Punic War with commodity money, with the silver and the gold that was around. The old aristocracy and the new capitalists ruled with the wealth. And you can imagine, because these wars are going on, that everything is vulnerable. You know, people are vulnerable to that, you know. The plutocracy financed the Second Punic War. The contractors commanded sufficient reserves to make deliveries to the Roman government on credit from 215 onwards. The war was funded by government debt by these private contractors, just like today, right? Just like today.
That's how they made their money.
That's how war is funded, you know.
So Carthage was destroyed. Rome was too, from the inside.
Say that again.
Carthage was destroyed in war, but Rome was destroyed from the inside by death.
That's right.
Is that what we're saying? Yeah.
By the money.
So we could destroy them all out there, but still the debt, our debt's going to destroy us, paying the government contractors.
Yeah, well, you know, we're being destroyed by this private money system.
Yeah.
The Roman Republic after the Punic Wars, here's all the conquests. Macedonia, Greece, Carthage, inheritance of the kingdom of Pergamon, that one kingdom from Alexander the Great, Illyricum, the Balearic Islands, southern Gallia, Cilicia, South Asia Minor. The end of Rome's monetary isolation, the commodity money system. The silver issues, remember the denarius and the sesterces, ignored limitation of issue, and they eventually became the commodity-valued money. After 157, substantial amounts of silver were coined. After 150, little bronze was coined. They lost control to the temple establishments and the associated private merchants who controlled the commodities. In 46 BC, Caesar coined the gold aureus. You see examples of them there. With unlimited issue, gold became the sole standard of value. Silver and copper became qualified tenders. 46 BC. And this is some of the results of this change in the monetary system, the rise of the latifundia, the money liquidity converted to permanent land holdings. So the first latifundia were accumulated from the spoils of war, confiscated from conquered peoples beginning in the early 2nd century BC. Pliny the Elder was distressed as he traveled, seeing only slaves working the land, not the sturdy Roman farmers who had been the backbone of the Republic's army. You see the farmer on the left, mm-hmm. but he's pretty much long gone, and due to wars and debt, and you have these the rise of these big estates run by slaves. And a lot of the farmers, like today, a lot of the farmers were pushed into the cities to find work. You know. You also had Tiberius Gracchus and his brother Gaius Gracchus. Plutarch reported the first outbreak of civil strife in Rome. Well, Fran, why don't you read this?
Sure. So, 201 to 27 BC, later Roman Republic, the rise of latifundia, money liquidity converted to permanent land holding. So Plutarch reported the first outbreak of civil strife in Rome was the assassination of Tiberius Gracchus and his supporters in 133 BC. Tiberius and his brother Gaius, killed over the same issue a decade later, were land reformers. Oh, that's good. We like land reformers.
Yeah.
Tiberius passed a law to take back illegally occupied lands and distribute them to the landless Romans. Okay, so these are good guys that got killed. perhaps some monetary reform would have paved the way for land reform.
That's my comment.
That's your comment, too.
Yeah, you know, they still control the money. But these were brave men, very brave men. And here's the Roman Empire, actually end of the Republic, in 44 BC, at the time of the assassination of Julius Caesar. Look at the extent of what Rome has taken. All the way over to the Near East.
I don't recognize it. Where is Italy now?
Yeah, where are we?
Yes, Italy.
In the middle, the boot.
Okay. Oh,
where?
Yeah.
I don't see it.
You know, it's a matter of foreground, background. There's Italy. There's the boot. The red part is land, and the white part is sea.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And I excerpted this from Stephen because I just think it's interesting, you know, so much of what's happening to Rome is happening to us, right? So James Fraser, Golden Bough, how Eastern cults destroyed Rome's social fabric. A multitude, Will, why don't you read this?
Yeah, a multitude of Oriental faiths in the latter days of paganism spread over the Roman Empire, and by saturating the European peoples with alien ideas of life, gradually undermined the whole fabric of ancient civilization. Greek and Roman societies set the safety of the commonwealth as the supreme aim of conduct, above the safety of the individual. All this was changed by the spread of Oriental religions, which inculcated the communion of the soul with God and its eternal salvation as the only object worth living for. A general disintegration of the body politic set in.
So,
and he included Christianity as part of the Oriental religions.
Right. So today, what is our cults today? The cults that keep us from being citizens of our world.
Tea partiers. Not interested in the common good.
Well, Don't be careful of the dichotomy, them and us. What about economics, the economics profession? Sort of has, it's, Stephen calls it a religion.
Yeah.
Right? It's,
yeah.
It's taken out.
It's a cult.
Yeah, it's taken out the morality of people. There's no morality. It's just, well, those are the, you know, the laws of the market. And you know, we're not here to help each other. We're just run by this market economy. You know, that's what I take from this. I take the cult of the economics.
I think initially money was made to serve people, but then it became that people serve money.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, the values change.
That's wonderful.
I think that's why Stephen is always talking about the morality of this. The values, you know. And here's the empire. Here's the greatest extent of the empire in 117 AD. Look at that. Ah, pretty incredible.
But when you think of Christianity at the beginning, that didn't seem, at least what we're taught, that the ideals were not, were also, you know, looking out for your fellow man. So I don't know, how do these things get perverted, you know, is interesting.
Well, Diocletian, when he came along, he was a big economic reformer. He started the worst persecution of Christians that there was. And the reason was that things were getting very scary around the borders of the empire. And he wanted everybody to sacrifice to the gods of Rome, to get all the gods on their side and keep Rome safe. But they all knew that the Christians didn't worship the gods of Rome. So maybe if they could get the Christians to pay tribute at least once a year, I think that was the basic requirement, then that would help to strengthen their position with the gods. So they made it a requirement, and they really looked at the Christians and watched what they were doing. And that made it hard for Christians, because they used to sort of go on vacation or whatever when they were supposed to be paying tribute. They got out of it.
Paying tribute means send gold to the Roman gods in Rome?
Well, it might have been, yeah, I guess it would be, pay tribute would have been some kind of sacrifice. Some sort of sacrifice, whatever it was.
Monetarily.
And I don't know if it had to be an animal or what, but so the Christians, a lot of them said, okay, now we can't escape this anymore. We're in the spotlight. And then there was a huge amount of persecution. But it was because of this, they were so afraid of what was happening to Rome's strength, to try to get the gods on their side. Right. And that was the one time when the Christians were seen as not supporting the empire and the common good and helping one another. If they really cared, they would pay tribute to the gods.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is what was it about Christianity that got it so, that it was able to overcome or conquer paganism?
Well, I read an interesting book a while ago, and the thesis of that author was, when the emperor took Christianity as the state, he picked a certain sect of Christianity, not the ones that were out in the community saying, help each other. It was the ones who wanted power.
Constantine.
Constantine. But
so that it institutionalized that part of Christianity that was not the best of the Christians. I mean, that's one thing, you know, I read it. Other people might have read other things, you know.
Quite possible. I mean, there was a whole colony of Christians in early Arabia during the time of Muhammad, whole tribe of Christians, and they were people that had fled persecution by the Christians that became the big power dealers.
Right.
Yeah.
In the empire.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just saying, everything you're saying just doesn't answer the question.
No, I wish I had an answer.
Yeah, I'm just saying it's interesting, that's all.
Yeah, what's the question again?
Yeah, the question is how Christianity got so strong in the face of these Roman, you had the Roman legion, they had all the weapons, they were like, how did Christianity get such a big leverage that Constantine had to take them in and negotiate?
Well, he had a conversion. I forget all the details.
No, he got converted when he was dying.
I'm just wondering,
how did they get that? Did they have backing, money,
Well, I think at some point...
Let's move on, because one has the answer. I'm bringing it up because I'll look up.
Oh, yeah, if you could bring...
I'll see if I can... Yeah,
that'd be great. Okay. Precious metals drained to the east. This is one of the themes throughout this book. The trade with India for perfumed spices drains the monetary metals from the empire. Religious dues drain the money. Loans of gold drain interest to the eastern holders of metal.
So maybe that's the answer, is that Rome really got very weak. Not that Christianity got so strong. Anyway.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's okay. No, it's good. Ask questions. A steady deflation and scarcity of money most likely plagued Rome. The division of the empire ruled by two emperors. So you get this division. The empire is, one emperor can't hold everything together. So you get the Western Roman Empire, is in red, and you get the Eastern or Byzantine Roman Empire in purple. So, and I don't know all the details, it was hard for me to piece it together, but there were several emperors that shared their authority with other emperors, and this division started. And in 330 AD, we have Constantine the Great moves the capital to Byzantium and renames it Constantinople. And he uses gold appropriated from the temples to inaugurate the famous Byzantium gold coin, the solidus, also known as the nomisma. Okay, and there's some examples of it. The solidus, or nomisma, contained 68 grains of gold, half the ancient grain ox to cow standard. Remember that standard, 130 grains to the cow, half of it. Listen to this, this is pretty incredible. For 900 years, the nomisma was seldom degraded, always money, passed by tail, by the value stamped on it, was unlawful to refuse, criminal to alter, and death to deface or reduce to its bullion. I mean, that's a whole other thing, how that happened, what was going on there, And it took the place of Caesar's gold aureus coins. This became the gold coin, the solidus. The rule of law continued to degenerate in the Western Empire. And there's a picture by a European artist of the sack of Rome by the Visigoths in 410. And look at the Eastern Empire is pretty, kept itself together, but the Western has lost. The Eastern Empire at its greatest extent, 555 AD, there's the Byzantine Empire, the biggest extent of it. In the East, the Pontifex Maximus office, that's the head of the church, the cults, was called the Basileus. And the Basileus in Constantinople exercised the internal control over the empire's money system until it fell in 1204. So in the next couple chapters, as you read about the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages and all that, all during that period, the gold coinage was being controlled by the Basileus, the Byzantine Eastern Empire. And this is the very end. What I did was I took the timeline and I just put what we've learned so far, you know, about the monies. So I hope it's clearer, you know, since we went over this.
Okay.
And that's it.
Great.
Okay. Cool.
Over the ancient.
Hopefully.